Good evening. Welcome to Dominican University of California. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here tonight to welcome you. My name is Denise Lucy. I'm a professor of business and organizational studies and the director of our Institute for Leadership Studies and the proud partner to Book Passage, without whose support we could not bring these wonderful authors to our campus. So I want to thank you for coming tonight, and I'm wondering if this is your first time coming here. Who has come before? May I see a raise of hands? We have lots of fans. Fantastic, fantastic. Well, it's really a wonderful opportunity. And these campus fora are for our students and for our faculty and for all of you, our community, to come together to dialogue about important topics related to leadership across the disciplines. So what is leadership? Leadership is about affecting change. It's about aligning others to achieve common goals. And what a wonderful opportunity we have tonight to have our featured author for spending four decades of his life in the public domain to achieve remarkable change that has benefited our society. So I'm so happy you're here this evening to have the opportunity to join in the conversation between President Mary Marcy of Dominican University and Congressman Barney Frank. It's terrific to have you all here. Just so you know, these fora are recorded. You can watch them off of the Dominican website, the Book Passage website, our Penguin Radio. We have a live podcast right now that's being recorded, as well as aired on Channel 30 Public Television on Wednesday nights. We could not offer programs like this without the support, the generous support of Private Ocean Wealth Management. This is their fourth year of supporting this program, and we want to give them the opportunity to be thanked so very much. Private Ocean Wealth Management is personal powerful wealth management is one of the oldest privately and largest held wealth management firms in Marin. It's named seven times by Worth Magazine as one of the top 100 registered investment advisors nationwide and best wealth management firm by North Bay Biz. And I'm so proud to hear that this year, 2014 actually, Private Ocean was awarded the best place to work in the Bay Area by the San Francisco Business Times. That is amazing, isn't it? So they're committed to community service, and they engage us by bringing us all here tonight. And I would like to introduce their chairman and co-founder, Richard Stone, who will introduce our guests. Richard?
Good evening, and thank you, Dr. Lucy. Barney Frank is one of the most colorful, feistiest, and funniest politicians in American history. He's also one of the most inspirational. Congressman Barney Frank played a vital role in the struggle for personal freedom and economic fairness for more than four decades as a congressman from the 4th Congressional District of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Since adolescence, Mr. Frank grew up with a love of public policy, but under an assumption he could never be elected to office because he was gay. Through serendipity and determination, he was able to have an exceptional career as an elected official. His inspirational leadership created achievements in a wide range of areas, from financial reform to fighting discrimination against gays and lesbians. Representative Frank, member of the Democratic Party, served as chairman of the House Financial Services Committee from 2007 to 2013, and was a leading co-sponsor of the 2010 Dodd-Frank Act, a sweeping reform of U.S. financial industry. He was one of the first openly gay members of Congress and the first to enter a same-sex marriage while serving in office. In conversation with Congressman Frank tonight is Dominican President Mary Marcy. President Marcy is a political scientist who earned her Doctorate of Philosophy and Master's of Philosophy from the University of Oxford. Her research focuses on women in American politics, and she has published extensively on issues of diversity, leadership, and strategy in higher education. Please join me in welcoming Congressman Frank and President Marcy.
Welcome to Dominican. I think you've got you've got a good house and an eager house, as they say. And we're going to spend some time just talking a little bit in conversation with, as they said. And I've had the privilege of having a sneak peek at the book that most people just received in the last half hour or so. And it was mostly a privilege, but for someone who's moderating a conversation, I have to share something that's a little bit sobering. I read in your book that you say, "I was happy to learn that I have an aptitude for this work, and I am at my best in debate as a counterpuncher. The weakness which I have noted is my laziness born of a very low boredom threshold. And if I'm assigned the task of preparing opening remarks, expounding a point of view, I am easily distracted. But I respond well to the stimulus of opposing arguments, so much so that even when I am the sole speaker at an event, I prefer to debate my absent antagonists." I'm not sure I'm going to be antagonistic enough, but
no,
I'll do my best.
I don't need that. That's
I can be okay. Cranky. I'll work on it. I do want to share, I want to make sure we get time to talk about current events, because I think one of the things we miss is your not only voice, which we hear occasionally on TV, but your presence and influence in current events, particularly with some of the things that are going on right now. But before we dive into that, I'd like to talk a little bit about how you got to be the leader and the legislator that you are, because I'm not sure that people know the backstory, and your book is fascinating in talking a bit about your work in Freedom Summer, your journey to Harvard, the fact that you still haven't submitted your PhD thesis. We're a little worried about that. We're still waiting. Could you talk a bit about how you became involved in politics, and including some of the personal choices that you made about how to run for office?
Well, it begins in part with my father, who was what today is called an early adopter of technology. He bought a television set in 1940 when I was born. There were not many programs, my mother tells me. NBC, the sole broadcaster, would send out a postcard every week with the programs, and if there was a change, we would get a phone call. There was a... So I was watching television early on. One of my earliest memories is of the hearings that were held into organized crime by Senator Estes Kefauver. And if you want to get a flavor of them, think of The Godfather. There was this set of scenes in The Godfather where a mafia boss is about to testify and then is persuaded not to, and later slits his wrist. It's too late to worry about spoiler alerts for that movie. There were these United States senators grilling these mobsters. Interesting, this is 1950. Television was so new that there were not yet rules about your right to be televised. There was an argument that you had a right to resist. And in fact, the compromise they worked out was that if you did not want to be televised, you would testify, but they wouldn't show your face. And there were some fascinating scenes. The head of the mafia at the time, the capo di tutti capi, the boss of all bosses, Frank Costello, testified, and he refused to have his face on, so you just saw his hands. It was this extraordinary, I don't know if they saw the kinescope. At any rate, it was 10, I didn't understand the fullest issues.
And you're in New Jersey, so this is personal.
Oh yeah, no, this is, I grew up in the area where On the Waterfront was accurately filmed. And so I had known by then and early on that I had verbal felicity. I was not good with mechanical things, but I could talk pretty good. And as time went on, I kind of began to be interested. And I do remember 1954 being appalled by the murder of Emmett Till, also 14, a black teenager from Chicago who'd gone to Mississippi. They said he'd looked in the wrong way at a white woman and savagely, brutally killed him with law enforcement involved. And then there was nothing anybody could do about it because the federal government could not intervene because of the Southern filibuster. And I do remember being very angry and saying, how could this happen in America? At the same time, another set of hearings came up. There were hearings being conducted by a Senate committee to talk about Senator Joseph McCarthy's attacks on the United States Army. Now, McCarthy was a terrible demagogue and bully and ruiner of people's lives. And frankly, when the Democrats were in power, some of the Republicans thought that was a great thing for him to do to them. And then Eisenhower became president. He starts attacking the Eisenhower administration, and the Republicans decide they're going to rein him in. So here is this very effective set of hearings helping this bully destroy himself, and he was clearly doing that. And so I say, okay, there are things I'd like to do. I'd like there not to be terrible racism in this country and unfairness. I'd like there not to be people like him. And here's the way you do it. You do it through government, and you do it through talking, which I knew, you know, by that time, as I said, they were arguing with each other. Well, I knew by then I was pretty good at arguing, partly because most of my teachers at some point had said, stop arguing with me. The people don't tell you to stop doing something if they think it's going well for them. And that's when I first began to think of it. I had an older sister, Ann Lewis, who was precocious, and she'd been involved campaigning for Adlai Stevenson in 1952 when she was like 14. So I thought about that. When I got to college, I joined the Young Democrats, and I wanted to be part of this mechanism, government, that was the way in which you improve society in the direction I wanted.
And at the same time that you wanted to be involved in government, you also recognized that parts of your life were not acceptable to the general public. And in fact, the McCarthy hearings themselves used a lot of gay baiting in order to be successful.
As I said, in 1954, I knew, as I say in the book, that I had a lot in common with the other guys, with two differences, the teenagers. I was attracted to politics, and I was attracted to the other guys. And I knew this isn't going to work well, because homosexuals are very unpopular, beyond unpopular, despised. And to be in politics, you got to be popular. So how's that going to work out? And in fact, I so accepted our unpopularity and the impossibility of doing anything about it. And as you say, at one point, Joseph Welch, who was the lawyer who was hired to cut McCarthy down to size and did it very well, he was challenging McCarthy's chief aide, Roy Cohn, a vicious right-wing gay man who later died of AIDS, but who was a destroyer of people's lives. In fact, this whole hearing came about because he had an unrequited love for a man named G. David Shine, who got drafted. And Cohn was insisting that the Army promote Shine to positions for which he was unqualified, and got McCarthy to intervene, and that's what ultimately led to McCarthy's downfall. But at one point, Welch was confronting Roy Cohn because he had clearly leaked a document that he should not have leaked that was supposed to make the Army look bad. And he said, Mr. Cohn, where did that document come from? Do you know? I have no idea. He said, well, it had to come from somewhere, Mr. Cohn. Do you think it was brought out by a pixie? Well, McCarthy at this point intervenes to save his friend, who was fairly widely known inside the Beltway to be gay, Roy Cohn. And he said, oh, excuse me, Mr. Welch, you say a pixie. Would you define a pixie for us? And Welch looks very directly at Roy Cohn and says, a pixie, Senator, is a close relation of a fairy. Now, that was devastating to McCarthy and Cohn, and I cheered. I am a 14-year-old gay man who was very happy to see my side use anti-gay prejudice to advantage. So I decided, yeah, I want to be in politics. I'll just repress my private life. I'll never tell anybody that I'm gay. I'll never do anything about it. And so I get involved in politics. I am involved as a young Democrat. And I also worked with a very influential guy that people knew a while ago. He was murdered, actually, 35 years ago. His name was Howard Lowenstein. He was just the model of a pragmatic zealot. He was an organizer, and he had come up with the idea of bringing white students down to Mississippi to help blacks by calling attention to the brutality that they were subjected to. It turned out in the early 60s, if racists beat up black people and shot them, nobody cared. But if racists beat up and shot white students from the North, that became a national issue, and that was part of it. So they organized this participation by white students, mostly from the North, in 1964, and I had been motivated by opposition to racism really now since 1954, so I went down there.
And one of the things I love in your book and also in watching your career is that you're very clear about your positions and what you want to have accomplished. And I don't think anybody accuses you of shying away from an issue. But at the same time, you're very pragmatic. And one of the things you talk about with numerous examples, actually including the example of the mayor of San Francisco performing gay marriages when they weren't allowed elsewhere. You talk about what's effective in activism and what isn't. And it might be surprising to some people how you think.
Well, I'm a great believer in free speech. People want to call me bad names, that's fine. If somebody proposed in America that we have the kind of laws they have in France to criminalize denial of the Holocaust, I would be strongly against them. There was this bizarre man who was a preacher from Kansas, the Reverend Phelps, who used to go and picket funerals of Americans killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, saying that that was God's punishment for tolerating homosexuals. And the House voted overwhelmingly to make that criminal. And I voted with two other members, one of whom was Ron Paul, to say, no, you know, you really are not a defender of free speech unless you have stood up for the right of an abominable bigot to say despicable things. It's easy to be for free speech when you agree. But if I was going to ban things, there are a couple of things I'd ban. One, I would ban the use of metaphors in discussing foreign policy. Like the domino theory. But I would also make it illegal to use the words pragmatist and idealist as if they were opposite. Yes, you should be motivated by ideals. You have no right to use the coercive mechanisms of government to impose rules on people unless they are motivated by some legitimate concept of the greater good. And even then there were limits, but that's the only basis for it. On the other hand, once you have ideals, once you are committed to a set of values that you believe will improve society, then I think you're morally obligated to be pragmatic. What good are ideals that you profess that you do nothing to implement? They just make you feel better. They're a warm bath for you, but they don't feed a hungry child, they don't house a homeless person, they don't clean up a river, they don't do anything that's useful. So yeah, I believe once you have committed to your goals, then you should try very hard to get them implemented. Now, I've had two differences with some of my friends on the left. One is substantive, and I ran into this in Mississippi, and I ran into it with some of the people in the LGBT movement. There are dedicated people who are not only interested in integrating, they're not interested in integrating groups that have been discriminated against into American society. Their hope is that those groups that have been excluded from American society, African Americans before the Civil Rights Acts of the 60s, LGBT people in the 70s, that they will be the spearhead of a movement to transform American society. So it will be less materialistic, so it will be more idealistic. They don't want to make blacks and gays like all these other stodgy bourgeois. Well, it turns out that most blacks and gays want to be stodgy bourgeois. They don't plan to change society. They want to be like anybody else. And I think that's been one of the arguments. You saw this early on. There was a period when there were people in the LGBT community, especially you lesbians, because of the role of women's, the role of marriage in oppressing women, these kind of unequal rights, when people said, let's not be for marriage. Marriage is an institution of patriarchy, et cetera. But most lesbian and gay people want to get married. They want to have the rights of other people, and that blew away. Similarly with black people. The other one, though, is how do you achieve change? And there is this mistaken historical view that Mohandas Gandhi and Martin Luther King, they marched their way to victory. Well, both of them used demonstrations early on in their careers because they represented people who were physically and legally not allowed to vote. But once they got the right to vote, that was their chosen method. In fact, yes, Martin Luther King and others, John Lewis, they led demonstrations to get the right to vote. And the fact is, in our society, demonstrating and marching is too often a means for people to express their deepest feelings and get an emotive high, but not accomplish anything. I contrast the Occupy movement with the Tea Party. I didn't agree with everything in the Occupy movement. I thought some of their economics were a little raggedy-edged, but I certainly agreed with their concern about inequality and substantively much more than the Tea Party. And for that reason, I regret the fact that the Tea Party was politically effective and Occupy was not. I mean, to some extent in American politics, when the right gets mad, they vote. When the left gets mad, they march. Voting beats marching is a way of affecting political change.
And another way that you've affected political change is actually by working very effectively behind the scenes to develop coalitions and to think about how to get legislation passed and where to make the compromise. And some of the things that I thought were more particularly compelling in the book that I certainly didn't know about were some of the conversations you had initially in working on financial reform. And there's a section where you talk about Paulson and Bernanke and the infighting that's actually going on in the Republican Party. And you make a choice to protect them, actually.
People have asked, where did bipartisanship go and what happened to it? Well, what happened to it was Barack Obama got elected because the Republican Party simply refused to extend to Barack Obama the cooperation that we Democrats, led by Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, instructing me and Chris Dodd, that we gave to George Bush. I'll give you an example. In 2008, even before the crash, George Bush, early in the year, January, says to Pelosi and Reid, the economy is slumping. This is before you could blame it on the financial crisis. And I think we need a stimulus to protect the economy. And so they said, you're right. Now, as partisan Democrats, we had a certain interest in the economy not doing well, because this is a presidential election year, and the worse the economy, the worse the president and Powers' party does. But Democrats also believe in government. That's why we do this, and we believe in trying to help people. So Pelosi and Reid overcame their partisan instincts to see George Bush sweat, and what kicked in were their instincts to have the government do its job, and they delivered a stimulus for George Bush. 1 year later, Barack Obama, who's got a worse economy because he inherited this terrible economy from the Bush administration with the crash that non-regulation had brought about, asked the Republicans for help, and he got no Republicans in the House and three in the Senate, and the three we got in the Senate insisted on cutting the program down to make it less effective. Now, I didn't say that Obama asked for a stimulus. The reason is that the Democratic leadership, I think they've been great. I think Nancy Pelosi is literally one of the great leaders of our country's history. But my Democratic leadership has too much of a belief in focus groups. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with focus groups. Focus groups, you gather together people who do not have strong opinions about issues, and you give them these various scenarios to get a sense of what will have appeal. My problem is that there is a very high correlation between not having a strong opinion about an important issue and being an airhead. I mean, who doesn't have? They have focus groups for the just before the elections, in presidential election. Now, who was undecided between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama? Who has any serious conception of things? But anyway, based on that, they come up with these ideas. So they a focus group led them to think that instead of calling our effort to help the economy beat back a recession, we would not call it a stimulus. We would call it the Economic Recovery Program. My response was that this was counterintuitive. Recovery rather than stimulus. Everybody I know would rather be stimulated than recover. I do not understand why we were supposed to be for recovery and said. Anyway, they turned him down. And specifically, in September of, early in 2008, Ben Bernanke and Hank Paulson are intervening to try and stop the economy from collapsing. Now, I blame the conservatives for their deregulation, and by the way, I would be glad to talk about, there's this Republican myth that it was we liberals who caused the problem. My favorite, if you allow me, was Dick Cheney has in his memoir. I read Dick Cheney's memoir. I was in the Huffington Post waiting to be interviewed, and I picked up a copy of Cheney's memoirs, and I gave it what we call a Washington read. That is, you turn to the index and you look for your name. Mm-hmm. So I looked for my name in the index, and there it was. Cheney writes, in 2003, our administration tried to reform Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, but Financial Services Committee Chairman Barney Frank killed the bill. I wasn't chairman of the committee in 2003. The Republicans were in control. I had no say over what bills came up. I didn't become chairman until 2007, and as Secretary of the Treasury Paulson points out in his book, in my first year as chairman, I did pass that bill. And at first I was kind of really angry that Cheney, just makes this up, but I realized I have quite a distinction. Cheney lied about what I was doing in 2003. How many other people can claim this sort of association with Iraqi weapons of mass destruction? Because he also lied about what they were doing in 2003. But as the economy began to falter, Paulson and Bernanke were trying to patch it together pending or doing some reforms. The conservative Republicans began to attack him. I was by then chairman. They wanted me to hold hearings at which the Republicans could attack Paulson and Bernanke for being too interventionist, for abandoning the principles of the free market. And I refused to do it. And it was partly, you know, the partisan instinct would have been great. Let's watch the Republicans chew each other up in an election year. But one of the things that troubles me, is the theme of the book, is that the notion of government has become unpopular. And as people demonize government, we lose the capacity to do those things to improve and protect our society that can only be done if we do them together, because that's what government is. So I did not want to be part of undermining government, of these demagogic attacks on government. So I refused to have those hearings. And then in 2008, when Paulson and Bernanke come to the Democratic leadership, the Republicans are there too, but we control Congress. Now this, by the way, you talk about bipartisanship. This is the September of a presidential election year, 7 weeks before an election, the most politically tense time in the American calendar. And Paulson and Bernanke say, look, the economy is about to just melt down after Lehman Brothers failed. There will be no economic activity. No one will lend to anybody. You've got to help us pump some money into the economy. And unfortunately, and this was the case, the only way to do it in the short term is through the banks, who everybody's mad at. So we were being asked to do something that was A, necessary, and B, unpopular. And we did. And we passed the TARP, which I believe will go down in history as the most highly successful, wildly unpopular thing we ever did. We then decided that we would immediately try to change the system so it wouldn't be necessary again. But at that point, the Democrats were giving the Bush administration more support than the Republicans, who were demagoguing against it.
That's absolutely right. And one of the reasons I wanted you to tell a bit of the background is because I do think one of the key themes of your book is the notion that government can do good. And you really do go back to really the Reagan administration when you were a freshman in Congress, and the notion of starving the beast, that it's not about lower taxes, it's about making government so inefficient that people will turn against it.
Yeah, as I said, when I'm 14 and I'm thinking, gee, I'd love to do these things that are going to make society fairer, less economic inequality. You need some for a capitalist system, but we have way too much. An end to racial discrimination. Freedom for individuals from censorship. I wasn't yet thinking even about LGBT people, although I came to that. And I said, okay, here's the deal. I want to be influential within government, because government's the way that you make these changes. As my career progresses, for a lot of reasons, the prejudice against us is dropping, and I am becoming more influential in government, which is the good news. And the bad news is that as I become more and more influential in government, government becomes less and less influential in society. And you see it, there are three...
Correlation is not causality, we know that.
Three presidential statements that are important. John Kennedy in 1961, ask what you can do for your country. That is a pro-government sentiment. That is, no, individualism is not the answer to everything. 20 years later, Ronald Reagan in his 1981 inaugural says, government is not the answer to our problem. Government is the problem. And the question is, how did that shift happen? And my disappointment was with Bill Clinton, whom I generally admired and I'm proud to have worked with, but he followed a strategy that I think too many liberals try to follow. Okay, we'll accept the fact that government is unpopular, so we'll join in criticizing government in general, but instead try to support particular government programs. But the whole can't be smaller than the sum of the parts in the political world any more than the physical. And as you denigrate government in general, you diminish your ability, in fact, to make those other programs work. Because what Bill Clinton said in 1995 was, the era of big government is over. I had two problems with that. First of all, I didn't know when it was. I mean, apparently there'd been this era of big government. I must have slept through it. How did I get a chance? I don't remember big government while I was active in politics. Maybe 1935, I wasn't even born yet. Secondly, though, saying in an approving way, the era of big government is over, sounds like big government's a bad thing. And I have this challenge. People say, don't you think we should shrink government? And I said, well, how many fewer firefighters are you looking for? How many fewer people do you want to inspect the food? By how much should we shrink Medicare? I mean, there are some things in government. I want to shrink the military budget. I want to stop putting people in jail because people don't like the recreational drug they use and waste money. But on the other hand, there are things, I want more roads. I want more public transportation. But Clinton sort of threw in with that. And much of what I try to do in the book is to give the program that I think liberals should follow so we can get people back supporting government so we can do the things that we need to do to improve the quality of life in this country.
I want to talk. I want to talk a little bit as well about your evolution as someone who started in public life as a closeted gay man, made the conscious choice to come out, and the full story is quite moving and important, I think, for people to read in the book. There are a couple pieces I wanted to point out, one because I thought it was a great story, and the other because it's so relevant to San Francisco. The great story, or the great line, for those of you who remember when Tip O'Neill was Speaker of the House, is that you had started to talk to some of the insiders and say that you were going to come out of the closet. And what was Tip O'Neill's
Well, I had to approach Tip because there was a book that was written by some totally hypocritical gay right-wing politician. And I early on, when I decided I was going to run for office, I said two things. I will be a coward, but I will not be a hypocrite. That is, I do not have the courage at this point to tell people that I'm gay, probably because if I did, I'd never get elected. 1972 was my first election. I would not have won that in 72. On the other hand, I decided at the time that to be a gay man in public office and then support anti-gay policies is despicable hypocrisy. And I would be as strong an advocate as possible for gay rights. And if that led people to inferences, that was too bad. I wasn't going to pay the price of attacking the way I hoped to live. And this guy was a hypocrite, and he was jealous because I was starting to be known as gay somewhat, and he objected because he got defeated when he got arrested for having sex with an underage teenager. And so he wrote a book that hinted I was gay, and I thought that might become a big public thing. It never did. I was ready to come out, but I didn't want to come out under those auspices. So I approached Tip O'Neill on the floor, and I said, Tip, I got to tell you, there's a book that's going to be written about me that hints that I'm gay. Ah, oh, Banny, don't be worrying about that bleep. They're always spreading that stuff about us. He said, well, the problem is that it's true. He said, oh, Banny, I'm so sad. And he was very flattering, and he said, I thought you might be the first Jewish speaker, and he was very admiring. He ran into former Congressman Pat Schroeder, who you work for, and told her that, apparently, because of minute or two later, she saw me in the floor. She said, oh, thank God, you are right. I said, what's the matter? She said, I just saw Tip. And he said, oh, Pat, did you hear the news about Banny? It's so sad. She said, I thought something happened to you. By the way, he was not in any way homophobic. He was 100% supportive. He was reflecting what he thought the political climate would be, that it would be, as he later told, and this is the key phrase, he told Mike Barnicle, the political journalist, Michael, I'm afraid our pal Banny Frank is all through in politics. I said, well, what do you mean, Mr. Speaker? Oh, they tell me he's going to come out of the room. Turned out we were too pessimistic. By the way, I talk a lot about Tip and his reaction, and I got a phone call yesterday from an old friend of mine whom I'd been elected to the state legislature the same year, Tip O'Neill's son, Tom O'Neill. And he said very nice things about the book. I said, you know, I hope the way I talked about your father was okay. He said, we loved it, and they're going to have a big book party. So I was
perfect.
Reaffirmed by by that.
And certainly not for the first or last time, but certainly relevant for our conversation, San Francisco played some role in your decision to come out. The 1984 Democratic Convention was in
yes.
San Francisco.
I attended. I was still in the 70s. I filed the first gay rights bill in the history of Massachusetts in 1972. And I thought, good, I'm just elected that year. I'll be one of many sponsors, and you know, I won't get a lot of attention for it. But by process of elimination, I became the leader because nobody else signed on. I was the main sponsor. And I thought, well, people make inferences, so what? Nobody did. I think part of it was, to be honest, at that point, I eat when I'm under stress. I had a stressful campaign to get elected the first time. They often are. My tastes are not highly evolved in some areas, music, and I diverged from the then prevalent stereotype of what a gay man was. And that gave me cover. I wasn't looking for it. But they just, the straight people were clueless about it. mean, I'll give you an example later on, 1982, when I had to run for a tough re-election because of redistricting. And again, I kind of, my weight had ballooned, and I was too busy running to worry about, you know, whether my socks matched, to be honest, or that's before Jim, who has had a number
of... He just tightened you up very nicely.
Yes, Jim.
She did.
Jim has had a great influence in my life in a number of ways, that's the most trivial throughout. But there was a guy in the town of Swansea, Massachusetts, who approached me. I was running against a Congresswoman, Margaret Heckler, say this in the book, in a redistricting that was really to her advantage, but I ultimately won because the Reagan budget turned sour, turned people sour. But this guy said, you know, your opponent says you're associated with the mafia. Well, given the way I grew up, my father was ran a truck stop in Jersey City. That was not entirely inaccurate, but I didn't think she would care, and because it wasn't going to hurt me. I said, she said I was a member of the mafia? What do you mean? She said you like the boys in Providence. Now, in New England, Providence was the capital of the mafia. It's the only one. It was run out of Federal Hill in Providence, Rhode Island, Ray Patriarca. Clearly, as some of you have realized, she said he likes the boys in Provincetown, the gay capital. But he was so, it was so cognitively dissonant for him to think of me as gay that she said Provincetown and he heard Providence. And that, but as the 70s went on, I figured, okay, I've been a state legislator, I'm going to do this for a few more years. If I retire as having been a state legislator and come out as gay, in 1980-82, I would at that point have been one of the highest ranking gay people who came out. We didn't have many jobs, we didn't have anything higher than some state legislative seats. So I planned to come out, practice law, I'd gone to law school, and be a gay rights activist. Because I could not live, by the mid-70s, I was frustrated in the total denial of a personal life. And some people say, well, you have a career, you don't need a personal life. No, it made it worse. We would go to these parties. I was the hero of gay people because I was sponsoring the legislation. And I would be praised and everybody would have a good time. And then the political meeting would turn into a party and I'd go home alone. And it was just devastating to me personally. So I'm not going to fight for rights and then voluntarily eschew them myself. So I was getting ready to come out and tell people I was gay. And then, as you will find out in the book, the Pope intervened. Namely, I was living in Tip O'Neill's district. Obviously, I was very happy for him to be the congressman. The district next to mine had a very liberal congressman and a collection of liberals that made it possible for me to win the seat. His name was Robert Drynan. He was a Jesuit priest. And when the new Pope, John Paul II, came in, who was determined to kind of crack down on some unorthodoxy in the church, he was persuaded to get rid of Drynan. He didn't want to single out Drynan, so he announced that no member of the clergy could serve in any public office. And that led Drynan to decline to run again, which created the vacancy which I filled. Drynan later said, he was a great man, he died just a couple years ago, that he regretted that he was never allowed to talk to the Pope because he was dying to say to him, Your Holiness, that business with you getting me out of Congress, did that work out the way you had expected it to? I was the replacement. But at that point, I had a chance to go to Congress, which I'd never expected I could. And at that point, the closet door slammed because I knew I could not get elected. So I get elected, and I say, okay, I'm going to go to Washington, and I'm going to try to live privately as a gay man, publicly be not out. I couldn't start that till 1983, because I did have the tough redistricting election, which I won. And I was trying to work that out, and I wasn't sure how to do it. And I attended the 1984 Democratic Convention here in San Francisco. And I was with a friend who was a platonic friend, a young man. It was not a physical or sexual relationship, but he was a good friend. And the first party I went to that was not a purely gay party, and I realize this now, I mean, I could recall it, with a gay man as a companion was right here in Marin. It was in Barbara Boxer's house, because Barbara's district at that point, she lived in Marin, and her district went from Marin into the city.
Yep.
And I mentioned this to Barbara. I said, you know, this is kind of a date, and she was very encouraging to me. And then I went to back into the city and went to a dance at a gay bar, and then Walamanda asked me to speak at the convention. And I very emotionally said, you know what, my life just came together, that I had managed to integrate my life. And from there, I began to plan on coming out publicly. It took me to 87 to get all the ducks in order. I will say, this was not the only role Barbara played. You'll again read this in the book. I began dating a man in 1987 after I had publicly come out. I volunteered to come out. I was the first. My colleague Gary Studs had been involved in an affair that led his being outed. He acknowledged it, but he hadn't volunteered it. I was the first to volunteer it. And then I was dating a man and Herb Moses, and we went to the White House to the annual Christmas party. Mm. And I believe we were the first gay couple to be there. Later on, I noted when Jim and I would go regularly, things got a little better. We would often, as we were walking by, a member of the military honor guard that was there would tell us, you know, cheer us on. There was some closeted gay people there. But this was under Reagan, and Reagan was older. He was feeling his age. He went up to bed early, seriously. And it was kind of like, you know, one of those, I don't know what, Tom Cruise movies or something. So the members of Congress got a little raucous, and there was like loud, fast dancing all over the White House, ground floor. And Herb and I wanted to dance, but we were, this is 1987, December, we were kind of afraid to do it by ourselves, to dance two guys together. We were easing into this. So I said, wait a minute. And I approached two of my colleagues and said, maybe they'll start us off. And I figured, okay, the one rule is you never want to get a colleague in political trouble. So who do you approach to ask you to help initiate same-sex dancing in the White House? You pick people from San Francisco. So Barbara Boxer and Nancy Pelosi, who had just been elected, go out on the floor with me and Herb, and we gyrate. And as Barbara said later on, yeah, pretty soon I realized I'm kind of stupid standing here dancing by myself. And Nancy and Barbara walk off the floor, and Herb and I got to dance. Later, by the way, we made progress, and Jim had his spouse pin and became, I mean, I have to worry about that. In fact, widely accepted, as a story, I'll tell this story in the book. In the midst of the financial crisis, I'm trying to persuade the Democrats that we have to vote to adopt the Bush program, because otherwise it'll be worse for the people we care about. We're trying to improve it. We're going to lend money to the banks, but we're going to try to crack down on excessive compensation. We want some money to be used for mortgage relief, although that's the one area where Paulson let me down and didn't do it, but we try to force them. We were going to make them pay us back more. And so I would have to stand up before the Democratic caucus and tell them that they had to do this. And Jim, frankly, was living a normal life, doing his owning business, and he voted, and he was an informed citizen. But he had not been as involved in politics. And one weekend, I guess I call him up and say, okay, you know that great weekend we had planned? We had started dating in 2007. Can you come to Washington instead and, you know, sit outside Nancy Pelosi's office all night while we negotiate for this? If you read Hank Paulson's book, you'll find a reference to him in the index as saying that he needed me to keep the deal from falling apart, and he sent his chief of staff to find me, and Jim and I were having dinner up in an area of the house. But I was standing before the Democratic caucus persuading them to vote for this, and they had Chinese food laid out for us. And Jim, seeing me standing there, kind of prepared, knowing what I like, and prepared a dish, but he was going to save it for me. And then I said at one point, geez, I hope, you know, we finish this while there's still some food left. So he decided in a very loving way that he would bring me the food. Now, while I'm up in front of the Democratic caucus, he's standing on the side. So he tries unobtrusively to come up behind the table to hand me the plate of food. And at some point, it becomes clear what's happening. And the room breaks down. This was a very moving and important moment. Led by the women in the caucus, you hear, oh, a loving. And he has become, as I said, at one point, he approached, and you know, one of the things that some of my colleagues had said to me when I was telling them I was going to come out was, oh, don't do that because you'll diminish your influence. This is in the 80s. You know, you're our great ally in a whole range of liberal issues, economics and environment and racial discrimination, cutting the military budget. If you come out, you'll be pigeonholed. You won't be as effective. You know, obviously, we think you should have a good life, but we fear you'll be diminished as an ally. My answer to them was, I don't know. I can't deny that that might happen. I hope it doesn't, but I can't live this way. And it turned out we were too pessimistic, and it didn't. But they immediately afterwards said, well, not immediately, well, glad you did this, because legislating is very personal. And I became nicer. When you're eating away by something, your tolerance isn't there. And it culminated with when I was chairman of the committee, and there was the Republican leader of the committee, the ranking member, he's called, the minority leader. And we would fight sometimes. And one day, Jim was there, and he ran into him, Spencer Backus, in the hall. And Spencer said to Jim, oh, I figured you were in town. Barney was a lot nicer to me today. So, yeah, that was very important because, frankly, you know, at first there was this tendency to just see us, okay, he's a gay person. But it was important for them to see us as part of a loving couple, to think about us as being together. And then, by the way, by 2010, when I had my last serious challenge, my last race, because of the problems that I had gotten from being the chairman of the committee and having to do these unpopular things, they thought they had a serious chance to beat me. So they went after the gay issue in a subtle way. Jim became a campaign issue. No terrible spouse, it's hard to fight back. But they would make up stuff seriously about Jim and put it in the paper, which is a subtle way of reminding people that I was part of a gay couple. And it had me worried for a while, but I did win by 11%, so we survived.
More than survived. And unfortunately, I can't talk to you about your serious successes in legislation against discrimination and your own identity without asking you about what's happening in Indiana right now.
I am very happy about Indiana. Here is the deal. 6 months ago, we were worried. We are winning the fight against discrimination. So the last defense for the people who want to discriminate was to invoke religion. And it's true, Congress did pass a Religious Freedom Restoration Act. I voted for it. But here's the distinction. Lawyers will know the distinction we make between a sword and a shield. In the legal theory area, a sword is a legal doctrine that protects you against other people intruding on your life. I mean, a shield. A shield gives you protection against others. A sword is a way in which you can go after them and intrude on them. Now, when we passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, what we believed it to mean was that if you wanted to wear a yarmulke, if you wanted to kill a chicken in a certain way, and it wasn't affecting other people, that became somewhat controversial, the rest of the society couldn't tell you to stop engaging in your religious practice because we didn't like the way you were doing it and it didn't harm anybody else. But then they began to convert that into giving you a right to discriminate against other people and to say, not that you know, let's take same-sex marriage. The principle of religious freedom says you don't have to have a same-sex marriage. It doesn't mean that you can then go after other people who do. But we were afraid of that. And then comes Indiana, and I have said in the book, I consistently underestimated the rate of progress. I thought I'd finally gotten sufficiently optimistic, but I have just been wonderfully, pleasantly surprised by the beating Mike Pence is taking. And here's the story. He now has to get up and announce, that a bill whose sole purpose was to allow people to discriminate against gay people does not allow discrimination against gay people. I will tell you, I've seen other people, I have a rule for my fellow politicians. No matter how much you think it is important in a given situation, don't say something that no one will believe. It will not help you. No one believes Mike Pence when he says this. Or Jim had said before that He apparently thinks he's the only one in the world who knows what the bill really meant. Everybody else who reads English somehow got it wrong. And what it means is that, and the great thing was the people who opposed it, businesses. Now, we're not talking about, you know, Whole Foods or the organic barefoot group. Cummins Diesel. They make the engines for big trucks. What could be more iconically Midwestern American than diesel engines? Eli Lilly, the drug manufacturer, the NCAA. And what I think you have seen is an outpouring from mainstream America that says, enough already with this hate, enough with discriminating against people. And I think this is going to be the last gasp of that kind of prejudice. So I'm very encouraged by it.
And I also need to ask you, in terms of current and perhaps future politics, about your longstanding support of Bill and Hillary Clinton and your thoughts about what may be on the horizon, at least for Hillary.
I was very proud to have supported the Clintons against these attacks on their integrity. And I know a lot of people said, well, Hillary Clinton, one more thing. I followed this very closely. Kenneth Starr, the kind of... You know, who's absolutely out of Les Miserables in his obsessive effort to convict her of something. And I was on the Judiciary Committee. And I will tell you this, he investigated the murder of Vince Foster, the Whitewater issue, the travel office files, the FBI files. And what he came up with to in any way impugn Hillary Clinton's integrity was absolutely nothing. I got to ask him in 1998, he had reported before the congressional elections that Bill Clinton had had oral sex with Monica Lewinsky and should be impeached. And he, in fact, gave 11 counts to impeach Bill Clinton. They were 11 ways to say oral sex. That literally, that was all that was there. And then after the election, he then reports that he found nothing about anything else. And I'm very proud. I nailed him in the questioning, and the press noticed this. So here's what troubles me, Mr. Starr. Before the election, you told us the president should be impeached over Monica Lewinsky, and you were silent on everything else. Now, after the election, you report that there was nothing negative about Whitewater, the travel office, et cetera, et cetera. I thought it was my job to report an impeachment. If there was nothing bad to say, you didn't say anything. So that's the first thing I would say, that there was no kind of cumulative set of issues here. Secondly, I did disagree with President Clinton, some of his anti-government thing. And in fact, when he signed the bill that, frankly, put some restraints on Medicare and reduced the capital gains tax as part of his budget balancing deal, I voted against it. And I was very disappointed. In fact, I was quoted in the New York Times. I organized a letter from Democratic House members opposing it. And I mentioned this at a press conference. And the press said, well, what did the president say? You know, what answer did you get? And I said, well, we never got an answer. I guess what happened was we sent a letter to the Democratic President of the United States, and it came back addressee unknown. But in general, on race and on LGBT issues, he was great. When Bill Clinton did sincerely try to get rid of the ban on gays in the military, and he was thwarted politically. But as a result, after that, in 1954, Dwight Eisenhower, reasonable Dwight Eisenhower, issued an executive order that saying no gay person could ever, ever get a security clearance because we were inherently untrustworthy. And Bill Clinton undid that in 1995. And he said that if you were gay or lesbian, transgender, abroad, you were being persecuted, you could get asylum here. And he was very supportive and did things like appointing Jim Hormel, a great San Franciscan, to be the first openly gay ambassador who, with his partner, went to Luxembourg. So, I did have those disagreements, less so with Hillary Clinton. One of the things I've said to my friends on the left, they forget it. Go back to Paul Krugman's column, the best commentator on public affairs today, a Nobel Prize winning economist who's very good on our public policy. And during the 2008 election primary, he documented that Hillary Clinton was to Barack Obama's left on a couple of things. I think I regret that there was a little bit too much of a military interventionism there. That was true of John Kerry. He voted for Iraq. Everybody was there. Obama was better. He's starting to get pressure. I do want to make sure that whether it's Hillary Clinton or any other Democrat, including the president, that they stand by this notion that we're not going back into Iraq and we're not going back into Afghanistan. But beyond that, I am very high on her. I think she is likely to be the nominee because she's the consensus choice of Democrats. People said, well, are you for some sort of family rule? No, if she's the nominee, it will be only one reason. The Democrats who participate in the primaries and caucus prefer her. The people forget this sometimes when they criticize who gets nominated. The process by which the American political parties pick the nominees for leader, the Democratic and Republican presidential nominating processes are by far the most open, small-d Democratic processes in the world for picking leaders. And if people don't like what happens, then they should go yell at the people who are responsible, the voters, because they're the ones who make the decision. And I also think that the email thing is going to be a non-issue. Nobody cares who used which email server. If nothing bad comes out, and nothing is going to come out, I believe, it'll be fine. And I did have somebody ask, well, how is she going to excite the Democratic base? Well, she's for fighting climate change, and the Republican won't be. She's for protecting financial reform, the Republican won't be. She'll appoint justices to the Supreme Court who will not only protect choice and protect our gains in the LGBT area, but could very well overturn Citizens United, which was only 5-4. The difference will be enormous. And I'll tell you, be honest, well, we need to have somebody run against her. I think there is a strain among many of my fellow liberals. We see ourselves as the purest minority. And some of us are not comfortable if we happen to find ourselves in a majority at any given time. And we need to find some thing that differentiates us from others. But at this point, I think in Hillary Clinton, we have an unusually strong candidate who represents a broad range of liberal values. And I have to tell my friends, you're going to have to accept good news for once.
I'm going to ask you a couple of questions from the audience. I know there's more than a couple there, but we have time for just a couple. One is also current events. What are your thoughts on Netanyahu, Israel, and the Iranian nuclear agreement or non-agreement?
First of all, I think Prime Minister Netanyahu has given America the model for how we should be responding, namely to differentiate between what I believe should be strong and continuing support for the nation of Israel's right to exist as a democratic Jewish state, well protected, and criticism of its government. That is, it is entirely legitimate to be supportive of Israel, but not supportive of Netanyahu. And when they say, oh, well, you can't interfere in Israeli, I mean, previously the argument would be, you can't interfere in their domestic affairs. Well, the man who came at John Boehner's invitation to embarrass the President of the United States has lost the argument that we can't interfere in his affairs. He can interfere in ours, we can interfere in his, that's fine. And I think the way we do that is, look, I think when your friends are doing something that you think is not in their interest, you have an obligation to tell them. Netanyahu erred badly when he said he was not for a Palestinian state. And the reason is this. I think it is important for Israel's own integrity and for it to maintain support in the world that it be clear that it's trying to get a two-state solution, understanding that it may not be possible and it isn't always their fault. I think historically, the Arabs, the Palestinians, made a mistake when they turned down Bill Clinton's offer and when they turned down Ehud Olmert's offer and Ehud Barak's offer. But what Netanyahu has done is taken the Palestinians off the hook. So now, even if there were to be a reasonable proposal that the Palestinians rejected, he'd find Israel being blamed because he's the one who said he's not for it. And he now says, well, I didn't really mean that. I was for it. There's only one way that can be made concrete, and I think our policy should be to say, yes, we're going to support Israel. We're not going to let the UN take a one-sided stand against them, but we will continue to do everything we can to get Israel to stop the settlements. The settlements are not in Israel's interest. They are contrary to Israel's interest. They're an obstacle to peace. They weaken Israel militarily and financially. As to Iran, I think the administration is showing now that they're not going to just accept any deal, but we have to. One of the things that want to be pointed out to the Republicans, one of the greatest areas of continuity between the Bush and Obama administrations is on Iranian nuclear negotiations. Iran did not start planning for nuclear weapons in January of 2009. Obama inherited this from the Bush administration. I would hope there would be some agreement to restrain them. What I do not think makes sense is to go to war to stop them. I am afraid that some on the Republican side, and I'm unsure about Netanyahu, are so unhappy with Iran, and I think Iran's badly governed, but I don't think they're irrational. And therefore, I think that they can be deterred from using nuclear weapons the way others have. I would like to see an agreement, but I don't want to go to war as an alternative. And so then the question is, I voted against the war in Iraq. It was a terrible mistake. I think the war in Iran would be a similar one. By the way, the only way by military means to keep Iran from getting a nuclear weapon is to occupy the country, because physically they will be able to go ahead with mountains and everything else and do it. So I hope they get the best deal possible, and it may not be possible. I see the Iranians are now, certainly the Iranians saying we just want a general agreement. That's not going to work. If they can get an agreement of the kind that they're looking for and retard and deter their ability to get a nuclear weapon, that's worth doing.
And the last question actually wants to draw on your wisdom as an activist and someone who knows how to get things done, coming out of frustration. Polls repeatedly show strong support for common sense gun regulation. However, it's difficult to accomplish anything. As a member of the Brady campaign, I'm disappointed. What are we doing wrong? And how do we address it?
Let me ask you a question. How many people in this audience have ever written to your state legislator or member of Congress and asked them to support strong gun regulation? Not enough. Here's the problem. Polls don't make any difference. To the extent that you're trying to influence people politically, polls represent people's general opinion. General opinions don't motivate votes. Every one of us in this room has opinions on a lot of subjects which are irrelevant to how we vote. And by the way, that was a larger number of people who said they cared about gun control. But I'll tell you this, if I was addressing an NRA meeting, everybody would have spoken to their legislators. And here's the deal. General public opinion doesn't do anything. What moves voters, politicians, other than their views of the merits, are communications from registered voters in their district that say they want them to do certain things. And I don't mean internet petitions. Internet petitions are a complete and total waste of time. I have had the experience of responding to people who signed internet petition saying, well, here's what I think about the issue that you sent me a petition on, and I get a call back saying, I don't care about this, why are you bothering me? So you signed a petition. Well, I just wanted to get those people to leave me alone. The NRA, when a bill comes up, everybody who is NRA affiliated in your district calls you up or writes you or comes to see you. The intensity factor outweighs it. So the only way to win that is to motivate more voters to tell their legislators that this will determine their vote. Now, we have a problem, because unlike many of the NRA advocates who only care about guns, people care about other issues here. They care about climate change. They care about a woman's rights. They care about economic issues. It is an advantage to only care about one issue. And that's the reason. By the way, the NRA, they're not big contributors. And I would also, to go back to my talk about marching versus voting, have you ever seen an NRA rally, a shoot-in, a march-in? They don't do that. They are intensely disciplined about getting everybody on their mailing list to call their legislators, and that's why they win. And then here's the other thing, intensity. Colorado passed some good gun regulation, which, excuse me, I swallowed one. They passed good gun regulation after what happened in Colorado. There was a special election about some of the state senators who voted for it, and they all lost. Because in special elections, the average citizen doesn't vote. So the anti-gun control people turned out. The next full election, the pro-gun regulation people won again. But the lesson here is that the people who are opposed to gun regulation care more and work harder than the average citizen on the issue, and in our system, that wins.
So to wrap up, I want to ask you to share, I didn't know this was yours, I'd only seen it once in the last election, but there was a bumper sticker going around in the last election that I understand you were the author of, and I think you should share it with the audience as your closing remark for the evening.
It says, "Vote Democratic. We're not perfect, but they're nuts." And I am optimistic that at some point that will carry through. I think for a variety of circumstances, the anger over, great on you, let me take one more minute. Here's my frustration. We're the party of government, we Democrats. In the minds of many, we get blamed for anything that the government does, even when they did it. That's their great advantage. I'll give you one example. I'm sure you all have heard Democrats being blamed for the bailouts, the Democratic majority of bailouts. There were five bailouts in 2008 that responded to the financial crisis. AIG was bailed out. Bear Stearns was put in with J.P. Morgan Chase. The auto industry was kept alive. Fannie and Freddie were taken over with an infusion of funds. And the TARP kept the banks alive. Every single one was the initiative of George W. Bush. Two of the five were started and finished by Bush. Three we helped out. Well, that's part of our dilemma. But I do think that the American people are divided. Yes, they don't like government in general, but they do like government in particular. We have to help connect the dots, and at some point, I think that will prevail.
Thank you.
Congressman Frank and President Marcy, thank you for this absolutely brilliant evening. All of us in the audience could stay for five or six more hours, but I think that's unfair. But we do have one more thing. We understand this is a rather special day in your life.
So?
I hear somebody's bringing us something.
Where are they?
Our gift. Thank you so much.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Institute for Leadership Studies here at Dominican University of California and Penguin Radio, radio.dominican.edu.